Hello, this is Byron Richards, and you are tuned into my weekly wellness update podcast, bringing you the health news with my views attached, hoping to help you understand a little bit more about what's going on in the world of health and how you can use that information to your advantage. We'll start out with the news, and then I have a number of your questions to take up in a little while. The first news article, gum problems linked to early stroke in men. Wow. I think every guy out there should be taking note of this. Stroke before the age of 65 is significantly increased in any man who has suffered periodontal bone loss, essentially as a result of a longer-term issue with gum problems. So by the time you get to actual bone loss in your jaw area from, you know, not taking care of the gums, having bleeding gums, swollen gums, you know, the deeper pockets that start to accumulate and that kind of thing, basically not brushing and flossing for very often. So the longer you let that problem go on and on, the higher the risk for stroke at an early age. That's before age 65. And this is different than any other risk factor for an early stroke. So you could be having, you know, cardiovascular risks, weight problems, elevations in triglycerides, cholesterol, that kind of thing. This is an independent risk variable, meaning that when they factor out those other causes of cardiovascular risk, this one is its own risk. You might ask, why is that the case? Well, I've been commenting on this for a while, and essentially what the researchers have found is that when you have bleeding gums or swollen gums and you're having, you know, the periodontal type issue, there can be up to 700 bacteria, 700 different kinds of bacteria getting into your actual bloodstream. And once they're in your bloodstream, the new science shows that they take platelets, which are the cells that stick together for a clot that leads to a stroke, but they actually, these little bacteria, use platelets as part of a defense system, actually putting like a shield of platelets around themselves, kind of like a turtle shell over the top of themselves, so that your immune system can't see them. Well, that leaves you with all these little pre-clots. I mean, they're tiny, obviously, but when this goes on year after year after year, these things build up, they progress, and they have no problem sticking together at an early age for a lot of men. This study showed this was more of a problem for men than for women in terms of an actual stroke before the age of 65. So just one more thing to keep track of. It's definitely a situation where an ounce of prevention is a very good idea. All right, colostrum, digestive immunity, and digestive repair is the title of another one of my news postings this week. And this was quite interesting to me. Bovine colostrum, or human colostrum for that matter, this one study was done with human colostrum, but bovine colostrum, which we use as dietary supplements, obviously, contains the same ingredients. And what they found is that the colostrum had a high concentration of what the scientists called a magic ingredient, something called pancreatic secretory trypsin inhibitor. And what this compound does is it orchestrates the repair of the digestive tract. It's in a way a hormonal type signal that is in charge or involved with repairing things. And that is quite interesting because, of course, one of the issues is that if the digestive tract gets inflamed, it gets more leaky, or if it has something hostile in it, you don't want that coming back into the body. So there has to be a very high ability to repair the digestive tract. This nutrient found in colostrum, very, very important. There have been other studies with bovine colostrum in particular, which shows that it prevents the translocation of bacteria through a leaky gut. So it's doing it partly by a healing mechanism. Another study showed that the bovine colostrum actually lowers NF-kappa-B in intestinal cells. NF-kappa-B is, of course, the primary gene signal that is involved with regulation of the inflammatory process. So it seems to work by several different mechanisms. Partly by reducing the inflammation or swelling, and partly by actually orchestrating the healing of the leaky gut. So it's a very interesting compound and something that you may certainly want to consider if you have some kind of a history with or trouble with digestive issues. Another batch of studies out on bovine colostrum and the flu. And in particular, scientists are analyzing some of the ways in which this works. I mean, you have to understand, of course, that bovine colostrum is specifically given to help a newborn with the two primary issues a newborn is having, which is one, immune system function, and two, digestive health. So all flus, of course, start out in the digestive tract and magnify and grow and then move to the respiratory system. The flu doesn't actually start in your lungs. It always starts in the digestive tract, replicates, and moves on. So digestive health is, of course, very important. Colostrum is one ingredient that contains what the scientists are calling unique carbohydrate structures of a particular signature molecule called sialic acid. Sialic acid there's little projections of these sialic acid carbohydrates from every cell in your body, and a virus is looking for them, and it's looking for the way in which the sialic carbohydrate is folded to tell if it's a human cell that it can latch onto. In other words, you have viruses that affect different animals. Well, they're all latching onto sialic acid, but the cell signature on a pig or a bird or something is different. That's of course why when a virus learns to see sialic acid signatures on human cells, all of a sudden now it can transmit from human to human. So sialic acid, it's not just one thing. The molecules are bent and folded and they look differently, and that's how viruses become problematic to one type of animal or another, including humans. At any rate, bovine colostrum contains a lot of these sialic acid carbohydrates, which act as viral decoys. And what I mean by that is a virus will attach itself to the sialic acid carbohydrate, and once it attaches it to it, it thinks, of course, it's a human cell, which it isn't, and it can't go inside of it. And it gets stuck to it. So normally, when a virus infects a cell, it goes inside of it, replicates, comes back out, sheaths itself off of the where it got bound onto, and goes on and does more damage. Well, in this case, it can't go into a cell because none's there, so it can't do its thing, which means it can't actually free itself from the sialic acid. So it's a very nifty way of tricking a virus, because you're not even going into battle with it. You're just it's kind of like flypaper. You stick it to it, and it just goes on out your body, and that's great. That's how, why would a little baby want to have to fight a virus? Why would you have to have an all-out war? I mean, if you need to have one, you need to have one, but anytime you can just render things inert and usher them out of the body, that's great. Not making any claim here, of course, that this would prevent any specific kind of flu, but it certainly couldn't help anyone. It's a tool that Mother Nature has provided that has enabled the survival of the human race. So it's not a trivial thing. This is just one more aspect of how colostrum may be able to help. Colostrum, of course, contains ready-made antibodies in the IgG family, which are also helpful for a number of reasons. And so there's probably a lot of different mechanisms. In my article on this, I've referenced some studies. A link to them, of course, so you can read what the scientists are saying and the properties of colostrum. But it is certainly a tool you would want to have in your toolbox for immune system support. Lack of omega-3 fatty acids kills 84,000 people per year. So the Center for Disease Control just funded this study. And it was looking into self-inflicted causes of death, and of which obesity leads the pack, besides smoking, which is still number one. But obesity is at 216,000 people. Just not getting off your duff and exercising apparently killed 191,000 people in 2005. This is amazing. That's 400,000 people a year dying because they're overweight and inactive. And then we throw in another 84,000 because they didn't have enough omega-3 fatty acids in their diet. Simple nutritional deficiency. pretty amazing. You know, of course, vitamin D would be another one, but this data, and you know, this is not a small study. This is a, you know, major government-funded study of the population, looking at different databases and extrapolating based on what's known about the risk factors and so on. And you know, these are just basic things that are so easy to do. You know, watch your weight, exercise, and take some omega-3 fatty acids such as DHA, which is the preferred form, and you significantly improve your odds of being around longer with a better quality of health. Not very difficult, pretty easy to do. Aerobics promote a more youthful brain. Well, most of you who follow me know that I am a big proponent, as part of your exercise program, of doing something aerobic in nature. For some people, that's getting out and walking. For others, it's jogging. And that's, for others, it's biking. Whatever the activity is, you want to stay active. This test was in a smaller group, I believe 7 men and women, ages 60 to 80. And in those who did 3 hours of aerobics per week for 10 consecutive years, they had far less abnormal twisting of blood vessels in their brain that reflected poor circulation. In fact, the blood vessels in their brain looked very similar to younger adults. This is specifically from exercise. We know that aerobic exercise, because it is, in a sense, a form of stress to do exercise, your body has to perform and so on, it triggers natural healing processes. It triggers brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which helps brain cells grow and repair. There was another study showing that when you run over age 50, it cuts your death rate in half. And this was a much larger study when the participants started in their 50s, and when they started running 4 hours a week, 20 years later, they were down to an hour and 6 minutes, so they had, or an hour and 16 minutes, rather, so they weren't doing as much as they could when they were younger, but they had much better metabolism, much better body weight, much better handling of sugar, and they had much less cognitive decline, which would be consistent with this current study, much less cardiovascular disease, and even much less joint problems. They have much less wear and tear to their joints than non-runners, which is interesting in and of itself, because when that study started, everyone was saying, oh, all these people are going to need knee replacements and hip replacements, and they didn't. So the data's in. If you run consistently 3 hours a week, in your middle and older age, you can significantly improve the health of your brain, and that is no longer open to debate. You can either do it or not do it. Acid-suppressing medication creates dependence. Well, this is another study in a long string of studies that is now beginning to shine a very negative light on the proton pump inhibitors like Prilosec and Prevacid and the purple pill, Nexium, these kind of things. And, of course, individuals take these medications so that they don't have a symptom of acid reflux or stomach problem distress. And I always like to say that these medications are like throwing fire retardant on a forest fire. Sometimes they might be helpful, just as stopping a forest fire would be helpful, but nobody in their right mind would manage a forest on a day-in and day-out basis by continuously throwing fire retardant on trees. So why does the medical profession and individuals, well, I know why individuals do it, because they have symptoms. It's kind of like Michael Jackson, you know, he's got a pain and he can't sleep, so he's got, you know, ever-evolving system of medications and drugs, and then he has a problem. Well, I mean, this goes on for everyone all the time. And the issue is here, you know, putting out the stomach fire or the esophageal fire with a medication. Well, what they're finding now is that what they did in this study was they gave these to healthy people and left them on them for a couple of months and then took them off. And they all started having indigestion. The very symptoms, the medication, in other words, it had an acid rebound effect, making the medication functionally addictive, meaning that it's not, you know, technically addictive in terms of addicting a region in the brain that would be associated with narcotic drugs, but it's functionally addictive, meaning that once it gets into your body and starts working in your body, you can't get off it without having symptoms that make you want to keep taking it. And, of course, it's not the only drug that's functionally addictive. That's how drugs sell. So we got this big issue here, and we'll talk about that a little bit more because I have a question on the subject as well later on. But there is no shortcut to good digestive health. You actually have to do a lot of things right, and when you do them right, your digestive tract moves forward in the right direction, and you don't have to do the problems. You don't have to have the reflux. If you have reflux-type issues, you want to address it because your digestive system is fundamental to your health, or you must maintain it in an optimal condition. A study out here, butyric acid improves fat-burning metabolism. Butyric acid is a 4-carbon fatty acid. It is typically synthesized from fiber in your digestive tract by friendly flora. So in other words, by the time fibers get down to your colon, you have a lot of flora down there that metabolize the fiber. One of the key things they make is butyric acid. Butyric acid is needed to heal the colon. It's the primary fatty acid that provides the integrity of the digestive tract lining. And it's and in no small way, butyric acid deficiency leads to colon cancer quite readily because cells cannot repair themselves properly. So butyric acid is incredibly important in general for a number of reasons. I found this study kind of humorous. I mean, yes, the best way to make butyric acid is to have good flora, friendly flora. Take some acidophilus to help produce it. Have some extra fiber in your diet. Americans are lacking fiber. They're lacking friendly flora. No wonder they have a butyric acid deficiency that leads to health problems. But, you know, this study was in the American Diabetes Association Journal, a journal I definitely look at from time to time just to see what humorous things are in it. And to me, this study was a little bit funny because, of course, the Diabetic Association is always telling people not to eat butter, which is the number one food source of butyric acid in the food supply. I'm not opposed to butter, as any of you know. Just have it in moderation. Have it with your meals. Not very much. A little bit will do you. But, hey, it does have butyric acid in it. So the interesting thing about the study is they found that when they fed butyric acid to, this was mice, but when they fed it to mice, it changed gene signals that accommodated the extra fat calories so that fat metabolism was enhanced. Muscle metabolism and muscle protein structure actually improved. And insulin resistance from eating a high-fat diet, extra calories, didn't happen, nor did weight gain because of the butyric acid. Well, okay, this means, first of all, that all calories do not do the same thing in your body. You can't just simply add up calories and calculate, I have this many calories of fat, and all fats are the same. Some fats actually activate your metabolism. This study also says that, well, hey, if you have an imbalanced digestive tract and you're not making butyric acid, you're not going to turn on signals that would help you metabolize fat, and you're going to get much fatter from eating fat. So one of the angles here on metabolism, especially if you are overweight, is that you may be struggling with a lower colon overgrowth of bacteria or candida albicans or something that isn't right. It's out of balance. Stools smell bad. Maybe you're constipated. Maybe you have irritable bowel. Well, there's no way you have adequate butyric acid in that case. And if you're getting overweight in that situation, here's one reason why. It's not the only reason, but it is one reason. You want to fix that lower colon. Extra fiber, friendly flora would be top choices for you in this category. Okay, we are going to now move on to our questions for the week. If you have a question you'd like to send in, go ahead and email me, askbyron@wellnessresources.com. And this week we have a question from Janet, who says, is the whey protein in homemade cultured kefir the same thing as the powdered whey available commercially? If so, Is it a better form since it is fresh? What do you think of kefir for gastrointestinal reflux disease and other digestive problems? Well, Janet, kefir is a highly fermented food, meaning it is a dairy-based product that then has many different kinds of bacteria and yeasts in it that ferment and make this culture. And in that regard, if you like kefir and you feel good with it, it is something that may indeed help your digestive balance. And if it, of course, helps any kind of feeling of reflux, and it might because it's helping your friendly flora situation potentially, then it could be a food that would be a good part of your diet. I have no objection to kefir whatsoever. Some people like it. Some people don't. Is it the same as whey that's commercially available? The answer is not exactly. Whey in kefir is kind of this greenish liquid that if you ran the kefir through a, you know, a filter, like a linen filter or something, you would have this watery greenish stuff. That's the whey. It is full of living cultures. So, you know, for example, you can use whey as a leavening agent. You can use this whey from cultured kefir as a leavening agent in sourdough bread if you want, because of the bacteria and the yeast that are in it. So it isn't the same thing. The kind of whey protein that we use has been specially filtered, so it has no lactose, has no cholesterol. Of course, it has no of these flora in it. So it's a different thing. And so is it better? Well, it depends what you're using it for. It's not better as a source of protein because you're just not getting that much of it. And it does, you're not, you know, the high quality whey proteins stand by themselves as a truly superior food source of protein. But it is some whey. And so it's, you know, it's on your to eat list if you like it. Carrie says, I've been taking an acid blocker for a while, and when I try to get off the medication, I have rebound effects. Can you tell me the best way to taper off and what natural things I can take to help the acid reflux? Carrie, the whole issue evolves around getting your digestive tract to move forward. So if you think of it, when food goes down into your stomach, it's supposed to be your whole digestive tract, which is quite a few feet long. When the food hits your stomach, it's supposed to feel down there like kind of snapping a garden hose. You know, there's supposed to be a pulsing, waving motion going in the direction towards eventual out. And when that moves forward rhythmically and smoothly, it's kind of like ocean waves, something of that sort, then things go in the right direction at an optimal rate, and you don't have acid reflux problems. So you're always trying to restore that. Factors like stress, where you have a lot of adrenaline receptors all along the lining of your digestive tract, can paralyze that function. And most people who have a sluggish digestive system know that when they're out walking or jogging or exercising more, their bowels move much better, because when you get a relaxed, refreshed feeling, your automatic peristaltic motion, the waves of it, entrain themselves to the more comfortable, relaxed feeling. In other words, the digestive tract runs on the relaxed side of your nervous system. So anything that you can do to improve stress, whether it's exercise, extra B vitamins, more magnesium, those kind of things are basics for this process. With acid reflux problems, you range from the simple to the more complex. The rebound effects, basically, whenever you're trying to taper off of anything, you just, you know, do one of it one day, a half of it the next, one of it one day, half of it the next, one of it one day. You kind of wean your body. Well, after you've done that for 2 or 3 weeks, you can go to a half every day and so on. Now, then the question is, well, what works for your symptoms? Well, the basic things that work, in my experience, have been the digestive helper, digestive enzymes, which you can take with meals, which usually help you digest your food better. Because a lot of times, gas is just from the acid and alkali components of the food chemically reacting with each other. So a lot of times, digestive helper, that's the name of our product, will clear that up. And I know a lot of people that just take that one thing and then boom, their reflux problems are gone. Doesn't work for everybody, but it works for a lot of people. The next level of problem involves something in your stomach eating the food and making gas out of it. So you have an overgrowth of some bacteria or yeast or something. Simple case solution, easy place to start there is the GI Soother, which is a whey-based product also, but it's filtered for immunologic properties. It's very good at coating things in your stomach. And for a lot of people, that really helps. That, of course, can be taken with meals or anytime to help quench symptoms, and it either does or doesn't work. Again, for some people, it is spectacular. For others, they don't notice anything, so it's obviously not their problem. But my basic approach, besides stress management, is always with digestive enzymes, something like GI Soother, and some friendly flora, like Superdophilus is our product. There's a lot of flora products out there. You want to try to see and notice that that helps. Now, if that's enough, great. Otherwise, you have possibly more of an overgrowth of a problem. You may need to go to products like Candida Helper or Monolaurin or Oregano Oil. You may need some chlorella to help detoxify the colon. I mean, in other words, there's a lot of things you could do if you have to, but you start out slowly working with some basics, Gary, and then gradually you wean off, and that's how you get off the stuff. Jana says, I'm sold on whey protein. I used it to overcome medical damage. I used it in milk products daily. Now I am seriously sensitive, if not allergic, to milk. I've seen to my intestinal permeability, so the problem is not there. People like this need whey, but may never be able to use it again. Question, is there a substitute for whey protein? Answer, no, there is not. Probably egg protein is the closest. After that, there isn't anything remotely close. So it is difficult to use other forms of protein to make up for it. As to your underlying problem, the little villi lining your digestive tract, sugar is what they'll digest first. So milk sugar, if they have some inflammation in there, that's happening. But then the next level down relates to dairy proteins and dairy. And so if you could once upon a time digest these things, as you're saying you did, and now you're not able to, you've done something where you're in some kind of a situation of significant digestive overgrowth of a problem that is interfering with your natural digestive competence, Jana, I would absolutely work with things like Candida Helper, Monolaurin, even the digestive helper enzymes will help break down different components of food. But you may need some anti-inflammatories in there to help stabilize the lining of your digestive tract, like quercetin. But my point is this, you're saying you've dealt with intestinal permeability. Well, I don't know how you know that other than maybe you did some tests and you weren't as permeable, but you've got inflammatory problems in your digestive tract that you need to fix. And when you do that, you'll be able to tolerate some dairy again, most likely. Dick says, I have recently been taking large doses, 2 milligrams of chromium picolinate. I am doing this to reduce cravings for food. Is there any danger in taking 2 milligrams of chromium picolinate a day? No, Dick, there is not. There had been some concerns raised by some skeptics of potential mutagenic activity of chromium, especially in the picolinate form. That has been completely debunked by numerous tests, especially those published in the last few years, where exposing animals to various amounts of chromium picolinate, including extremely high doses, have provided no cause for concern for anyone. And essentially, the only time any problem can be produced is at doses that are so abnormal physiologically you could never take them. So just like water could kill a person if they took too much, I suppose chromium could as well, but you'd never get there. And 2 milligrams, while it's a high dose, isn't harmful. Carol, I have arthritis of the big toe joint. Is there something I can do without doing surgery? Well, arthritis of the big toe joint, Carol, is always an interesting issue to me. Because if that's where your arthritis is, you got to wonder, well, why is it there? Not in my knee and not in my hip and not everywhere else. It's just in my big toe. And so invariably, big toe joint arthritis, which you may not know this, Carol, but it's kind of been a fascination for me because I always wondered, how did it get there? So I've had a lot of people I've talked to with this problem, and I quiz them. And what I find, of course, invariably, is that they have digestive problems, and they have some sort of toxicity-related issue. So when you're sleeping at night and your body doesn't like toxins around your heart and your kidneys, it drops them off as far away from your heart as it can, which happens to be your feet or maybe your hands. But a lot of times it's your big toe. It's a dumping ground for waste products while you're sleeping at night. So you got some kind of an issue with detoxification that isn't working right. And then, of course, the toxins irritate the structure. And then you can get abnormal calcifications growing, which is even more irritating on top of the toxic accumulation and on. And eventually it becomes a big enough problem. Some people have to do surgery. Some people don't. What can you do about it? Can you take this problem apart? You can, maybe. You can use products like Daily Balancer, which help clear toxins better. Immune Plus is very effective at night before you go to bed to help clear toxins while you're sleeping so they can go out some other way so they don't have to go down to your big toe joint and irritate it. You can use Repair Plus, which will help take down old tissue that shouldn't be there. And this includes old scar tissue. Possibly it'll get rid of some calcifications. I've seen that happen in some cases, not in all cases. And increasing your magnesium is critically important to not forming any more spurs in that toe. And with any good fortune, if you remove who's punching your big toe in the nose, you might find that your big toe quits hurting so much and that gradually over time the problem can be reversed. But look specifically at digestive health, toxins in general, and that's where you'll make progress, Carol. Jill says, I have recently lowered my dosage of Armour Thyroid. My doctor said it was too high. I have gained about 7 to 8 pounds and want to know what I can do to prevent this. I have been working out a ton as well as restricting calories, but still feel like I'm fighting to keep it off. I take Armour Thyroid twice per day. What do you suggest? Well, Jill, you are in a problem situation that a lot of people are in. In other words, they fought their way onto a thyroid dose, thinking it was going to be the solution to their problem. They go to their doctor, and their TSH has been suppressed, meaning they are now living on too much thyroid hormone. And so the doctor says, oh, this isn't good. And the doctor's really correct. This isn't good. And so he says, take less. And so you take less, and your metabolism has a rebound effect, and it goes into hibernation mode because, just like with the antacid medication, which is functionally addictive, so is any kind of thyroid medication functionally addictive. So a couple things you can do. You say you're working out. That's great. So I'm assuming, obviously, you're in good enough health to work out. So you want to maximize the turning on of genes that convince your body you're not starving while you're working out. Rather simple to do. Take a lot of coenzyme Q10. I would use anywhere from 200 to 400 milligrams prior to exercise, and I would combine it with pantothene. You need to maximize your result of the workout to raise endorphins and to burn fat, which you can do with those two nutrients. I would also use a thyroid helper, which helps activate the thyroid hormone you are taking, and some isosol iodine to help your thyroid out, and anything else as needed to help your energy systems work better. Of course, you must follow the five rules of the leptin diet and not snack in between meals. Your system will rebound, Jill. It's kind of like the same issue of, you know, living on 20 cups of coffee a day and then being cut down to 10. It's not that 10 cups was good in the first place. It's just that you were functionally addicted to 20. Now, of course, I'm exaggerating here because people don't drink 20 cups of coffee, but you get my point. Stimulants are self-defeating in the long run. Sure, it's okay to have a little bit of caffeine in the morning to help, you know, kick things into gear, maybe help move your colon along as well, but it can easily be overdone. And when you start relying on these things and becoming dependent on them, you know you're going down a slippery slope in the wrong direction. So moderation is associated with health, and overdoing anything is probably not. Betty, my friend's sister is an RN and very knowledgeable about health issues. She says that protein shakes clog a covering around the kidneys, and that this is very dangerous. My friend really needs protein, and protein shakes were great for her, but she is afraid, and so am I. Can you clarify this? I will do my best, Betty, because we're talking pretty lay terms here when we're talking about a covering around the kidneys. The kidneys are a filtration system, and I'll use a different analogy. They're like a screen on the window. And that screen on the window, which would filter air, in this case is taking apart your blood and putting it back together again. But it is nevertheless a screen-like system. And apparently, your this RN that you've been in contact with is saying that protein coats the covering, Well, that would be, or clogs the covering. That would be a real stretch. What actually clogs the covering is sugar. Sugar clogs the covering big time. When you have your blood sugar start to go up, it's like spilling honey or maple syrup on that screen, and of course, nothing's going to filter well. Now, if you have a highly inflammatory situation, damaged protein molecules, advanced glycation end products, which will be a mixture of damaged protein and damaged sugar or excess sugar, will form a goop, and that will clog the kidneys. That has absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with dietary intake of protein. It has everything whatsoever to do with inflammation not being regulated. So, somebody, say, who has kidney problems that are severe, like meaning they're on dialysis because their kidneys don't work at all, yeah, the dietitians for years tried to restrict their protein intake, thinking that protein would cause more an increased filtration rate, put more stress on the kidneys. Protein does increase osmotic pressure. So if you have somebody, say, with significant cirrhosis of the liver, you might need to reduce protein intake so that not too much pressure is pushed through the liver. These are medical problems that don't apply to most people. But my point here is that even in patients with needing dialysis, their health deteriorates in direct amount to the drop in their blood proteins. So you have albumin, globulin, you have the blood proteins that which you build from eating dietary protein. And when those proteins drop, their kidney health goes to hell in a handbasket. And when you maintain their protein intake and maintain those blood proteins, they do much better over the long term. So your RN friend is looking at a very small slice of data about how protein can combine with sugar under inflammatory conditions and form advanced glycation end products that can clog the screen on the filtration system. But that doesn't have anything to do with eating a protein drink, Betty. And so you are unnecessarily worried about that. If you're worried about your kidney health, you want to take nutrients that are anti-inflammatory that have been shown to help the kidneys, like Silymarin, which or milk thistle extract, which a lot of people associate with liver health. Terrific for the kidneys. So is coenzyme Q10. So are anti-glycation products like carnosine or R-alpha lipoic acid or anything you do to smooth out how your body handles blood sugar. That's by far the most important thing. Following the leptin diet, nutrients like cinnamon or chromium there's many things you can do. But the key here is definitely keeping that kidney filter in good condition. And the biggest, largest problem is sugar. Too much. Steve says, I just got back from a cruise where the fitness staff was pushing the notion that everyone had to detox with the help of their $100 a month algae supplement program for at least 6 months in order to get rid of assorted toxins. These toxins supposedly accumulate in the lymph nodes and fat cells and cause all sorts of problems, including weight gain. Some of what they said I can verify elsewhere, but the presentation was full of questionable assertions and a number of logical fallacies. Is there any truth to the idea that everyone builds up toxins that can't be excreted through normal bodily processes? If so, what would help get rid of these toxins? Steve, you've hit one of my pet peeves here. The subject of detoxification, first of all, is extremely important. But secondly, these detox programs that hype themselves as cleansers of your system, and you do them and now you're squeaky clean, is entirely the wrong concept of how to go about this issue. But let me answer parts of your questions first and then explain what I would do. You're asking, is there any science? Is there something that you can delve into? And I did write an article, and you can just go into my search on the wellnessresources.com website and type in detoxification during weight loss, which is the name of an article I wrote a while back. But in there, I give you links to the National Human Adipose Tissue Surveys, or NHATS. They were conducted in 1982 and 1987. These were mandated by federal law. And what the purpose of them was to analyze the fat of cadavers from, obviously humans, from around the country. So, and what they found in these fat analysis was that in 100% of the fat samples, there were four industrial solvents and one dioxin. A dioxin is a a more advanced toxin. It comes from a PCB, and it's gotten more toxic. In 90% of the fat samples, there were an additional 9 chemicals and 3 more dioxins. So in over 90% of the people, of these fat samples, had numerous toxins. 83% had PCBs. In other words, there are many chemicals in the environment that are fat soluble. Some we eat, some we breathe in. If your body can't clear them out with its normal systems of detoxification, it has to put them somewhere. If it puts them into fat, which is a preferred source, partly because they're attracted there, because the compounds are fat soluble, so they go into fat, then they're in one way out of your circulation. So that's part of a defense mechanism. On the other hand, they start damaging your fat organ, which is actually an organ. So they interfere with metabolism of calories, absolutely throw a monkey wrench into weight loss, provoke weight gain, because your body will actually bind up toxins, stick them in calories, and stuff them in fat as a defense mechanism if your plumbing systems aren't working properly in the first place. So that gets to a more advanced subject that goes way beyond just taking a algae supplement as if that's going to do the job. Think more like this. Your plumbing is either working or not working so well. So take your house plumbing, for example. You use it every day. Doesn't ever, you know, you maybe clean it once a week or something. But you don't really get concerned about it unless it gets clogged. And so that would be an acute toxic backup. That could be constipation of your digestive tract. It could be a problem with constipation of your lymph system, which will show up as major pressure, headaches in the upper shoulder region. So you have these different areas that relate to detoxification, going from your lymph to your liver and then out your digestion or out water-soluble ones through your kidneys. That all has to work on a daily basis regularly. So if you feel acutely toxic, you can do things to help reduce that. If you have to keep this plumbing working. I would venture to guess that anybody struggling with fatigue, anybody struggling with stubborn weight, a percentage of their problem is plumbing issues where toxins are not only just building up in the fat, but there's a higher percentage of toxins in the lymph, in the blood, in a hostile digestive tract. So it is definitely a subject of importance. It's something you want to look into. I have an excellent detoxification health topic page on wellnessresources.com, Steve, that you can look into, and it will explain all of these things. And I would encourage you to do that. And if you have any further questions about the subject, once you've looked that over, please send me another email, and I'll take up any particular question that you may have. All right, well, that's it this week for your questions. If you have a question, you may email me, askbyron@wellnessresources.com. And I will be back next week with another podcast to your health. Have a great week.
The Weekly Wellness Update podcast is produced by Wellness Resources Incorporated, copyright 2008. All rights reserved. For more information on the topics and news covered in today's podcast, visit wellnessresources.com. To email Byron a specific health question, send it to askbyron@wellnessresources.com. The information presented in this podcast is for informational purposes. It is not medical advice for the treatment of any condition or illness. You should not use the information in this podcast for diagnosis or treatment of any health problem or to discontinue the use of any medication that has been prescribed to you. Consult your physician or healthcare professional for such needs. Statements made during this podcast regarding any Wellness Resources dietary supplement products have not been evaluated by the FDA. Wellness Resources dietary supplement products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.